Dr. George Dimitri, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Over the past 5 years, 51% of all FDA-approved cancer drugs have had substantial input from Dana-Farber scientists and clinical investigators. And that comes from the culture here, the very basic curiosity-driven scientists that are probing really how cancer works.
At Dana-Farber, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hello and welcome to Five Things. I'm James Brown. It's Sunday, October 2nd, 2022. Go Bills. Every week, we take a question, idea, or concept in Go Deep. If there's something you'd like us to look into or just want to say hello, you can always email me at jabrown@usatoday.com or at podcasts@usatoday.com. You can also find me anywhere on social media at James Brown TV. We also have a voicemail line, 585-484-0339. I love reading and listening to all your messages. I'm a media geek, and I have been for just about all my life. And just recently, I found out something online that I just can't get enough of. Nielsen, who measures viewership for TV, among other things, began releasing something called The Gauge. We'll link to it in the description. Nielsen calls The Gauge a snapshot of TV viewing. Every month, for a little over a year, the company releases a graphic that looks like a donut, separating all TV viewing into four big pots. Cable channels like Fox News or the Discovery Channel or ESPN are in one big chunk. Broadcast networks, those channels that people can watch for free, like CBS, NBC, and ABC, are in their own category, as is streaming, including YouTube, Netflix, Disney Plus, and others. The fourth category is other. That estimates DVR and on-demand viewing. In July, something interesting happened. Streaming became king, topping cable for the first time. The same thing happened in August. Who knows how long that will last, but all things points to streaming taking over TV altogether. And that left me thinking, what is the state of TV? And how has streaming changed content? So I'm turning to an expert, USA Today's TV critic Kelly Lawler. Kelly Lawler, welcome to Five Things.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Pumped to have you on. And I'd like to start by asking you to complete a sentence, if you don't mind. In a word or phrase, the state of TV is?
Messy.
Go on.
Like you said, streaming has overtaken cable as more households watch their TV via streaming than watch their TV via cable. It doesn't mean nobody watches cable or nobody watches broadcast. And that's happened for the first time this year. But at the same time, streaming services and their corporate owners are kind of having an identity crisis. We saw this because Netflix lost subscribers for the first time this year. And HBO Max has been under new corporate ownership, changing its strategy, deleting old shows, canceling movies, and will eventually merge with Discovery Plus because it's under new ownership. Disney Plus is adding a paid but ad-supported tier for a cheaper price. And new streamers, they're not actually new, but they're probably new to your awareness, if you haven't been interested in this before, called AVOD, which stands for ad-supported video on demand, which just means that you don't pay for them, but they have ads. They're cable ported online as streamers. These are things like the Roku channel, Tubi, Freevee. They all have kind of funny names, but they're starting to get into the content space in a big way. All this means that we're sort of at a turning point, but it's very hard to predict where we will go from here. And the streamers are kind of getting less expansive and more expensive. Prices are going up all around, and the amount of content available is diminishing after exploding for many years.
Let's pick that apart a bit. It seems like you have two categories of streamers. You have the expensive streamers and the cheap or free streamers.
Yeah.
And the expensive streamers are in a bit of an identity crisis.
The original business model, which was established by Netflix, was to spend and to spend and to spend. They spent billions and billions of dollars on content. More was always better. The idea being that the more content you had, the more people you could entice to subscribe. The metric that streaming services care about is new subscribers and then also retained subscribers, because that's where they make their money if they don't have ads. We hit a point where this bubble sort of burst. There are only so many people on Earth with access to the internet and disposable income enough to pay for streaming services, let alone those who want to use that disposable income to pay for streaming services. And that came sooner than I think a lot of people thought. And now everyone is scrambling to update their business models. So that means purchasing less TV shows, making less TV shows. That means introducing paid ad-supported tiers so that they have a new revenue stream from advertisements in addition to subscribers. And that means consolidation. And that's what we're seeing with HBO Max and Discovery Plus. I believe in 2023, those services will be merged.
Who's doing it best at the moment?
It's hard to tell.
However you want to define that.
Yeah. I mean, if you're in terms of who makes the best content, you know, I still really love what HBO Max makes. It has really great content across a spectrum. That might change, again, because of the new ownership. In terms of who's probably making the most money right now, Disney Plus is in a very good position after their earnings call this past quarter. In terms of what I turn to the most because of convenience, the number of TV shows that it has that I tend to check in on, I've always been a really big fan of Hulu, although NBC just pulled their content from Hulu so that it will go on Peacock instead, their proprietary streaming service. So, you know, it's hard. It really depends on personal taste. It depends on what you're willing to pay for. And I think anecdotally, people I know are more willing to cancel than they were a year or two ago. And if Netflix or Apple or Paramount Plus debuts a buzzy show that they want to see, they will resubscribe for the amount of time it takes them to watch that show and then unsubscribe again.
It seems like it would be in part an economic decision to just quickly subscribe and unsubscribe from different services. And we're all so used to these now. Like, there's a lot of them and a lot of different options. And it's not mystifying to get in and get out.
No. And if you purchased a subscription for all of the major streaming services, you could run a tab that is far higher than what you paid for basic cable. So the idea of cord cutting isn't an idea of saving money anymore. And just like all other areas of the economy, inflation is playing a huge role in what people are willing to spend their money on at this moment. In a lot of cases, that money is not being spent on entertainment, or at least not 15 different avenues of entertainment, maybe one or two.
Nielsen considers YouTube with its streaming calculations. Do you consider that television?
YouTube briefly tried to become a streamer in the sense you would think of Netflix. Right now, it's a user content created streamer. There are others like TikTok would fall into that, Facebook Watch. Basically, it's when the company does make money off of people watching streaming video, but it's the users who make it. YouTube very briefly tried to create their own content, and they had one very buzzy show, Cobra Kai, which eventually went to Netflix because YouTube decided it wasn't really the business model for them. It's significant in terms of figuring out where people are consuming TV and entertainment to include YouTube in that Nielsen chart. I don't consider it TV in the sense that I'm never going to go on YouTube and critique the video that someone down the block from me created themselves, you know. But it is important in terms of figuring out what is happening in the industry.
Is it harder to cover TV now because there are just so many more outlets?
Yes. There are more shows than someone who had my job 30 years ago could have possibly comprehended. There was a time when TV critics would review every single new show that came out in a year because it was possible for one person to watch every single new show that came out in a year. It is no longer possible for one human being to do that. There are simply not enough hours in the day. And that's overwhelming. And it's not just overwhelming for TV critics and television journalists, it's overwhelming for consumers. And what that means is we're lacking a lot of monoculture at the moment. You know, the sort of height of my career, I would say, was when I covered Game of Thrones in terms of the amount of readers that I interacted with and the amount of work I did on a single show. And its spinoff, The House of the Dragon, is not getting the same kind of ratings it did, and it's not generating nearly the same kind of online discussion that it did. And I mourn that, because that is something I love about television, is the way that it can bring people together. And while we're sort of empowered by all this choice, and it's led to a lot of really great things, a lot of really great shows, it also is a lonely experience.
Yeah, that communal moment, you know, seeing Jon Snow just go to war against a million White Walkers. I don't think it's possible now, do you?
No, we will never have a show like that again. Amazon spent $500 million on their Lord of the Rings series, which is quite good. I very much enjoy it. And that was their attempt to recreate the Game of Thrones phenomenon. And while I don't know if its metrics are performing to Amazon's standards, again, the metric they care about most is how many people sign up for Amazon Prime, and the first show that they watch is The Lord of the Rings, the Rings of Power. People don't release those numbers. It's just they don't have to, so they don't. So I don't know how it's performing for them internally, but I imagine they are a little disappointed by the lack of water cooler moments. A lot of the online discourse had been basically a lot of harassment and hate aimed at the actors of color who were in the series, and, you know, not a lot of, like, wondering who the villain is or what the big twist is going to be, unfortunately.
I know that online reactions are generally driven by strong emotions. I would imagine that's partly why those are the things that are standing out for that show. Is it the quality of the show also affecting why it hasn't connected? Along with, obviously, we're in a different period of time.
Yeah, I think people use social media differently than they did just 3 years ago, and that's part of the issue. And people who, this is my opinion, but people who espouse a lot of hate on the internet tend to be a very loud minority. So you see a lot of volume without a lot of numbers behind it. And it's the kind of story that gets picked up by many news outlets. So that's why that tends to drown out other kinds of chatter. And there are people who are talking about it. I just don't think it is the wave of buzz that Amazon was really hoping for. And it might just never happen again. One thing also is that we're in this weird moment with the COVID-19 pandemic where people are going out and doing more things than they had. And, you know, some people say it's over. And it's affecting how much time people spend watching television. In 2020, people watch more television than they did right now. And that is affecting how they talk about it and how they spend their money on it.
Content-wise, comparing it to the height of your career, right? Game of Thrones, Mania. Have you seen the type of show developed now be different than back then? Or am I pulling hairs?
Here's the thing. It's the trend that's been happening for years. So it's not like things are so different now than 3 years ago. It's always been trending towards this. But there's just so much more mediocre TV now than there was 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And that's because of the volume increase. We're just at the point where streaming services are kind of starting to be choosier about how many and which TV shows they make. But in the drive to create more, 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 you get more mediocre. That's sort of what rises to the top. Like, you get some really good stuff and you get some really bad stuff, but the vast majority, when you just go for volume, is mediocre. And that's sad to me because, well, as a writer, it's not particularly exciting to write about something that's just fine. I would much prefer to write about something I love or something that I hate. And with so much mediocre stuff, really good stuff can get lost. You know, there's this show that I absolutely adore. It's on Peacock, which is not a streaming service that a lot of people have. It's not a streaming service that gets a lot of buzz. And the show is called We Are Lady Parts, and it's a British series sitcom about an all-female Muslim punk rock band in London. And it is just fantastic. It aired last year, and it is so funny and so heartwarming and so sweet. And I loved it. A lot of TV critics loved it, but I don't know a lot of people who found it organically. And that makes me sad because when there's so much more content, there's the ability for diverse voices to be able to tell stories that we've never seen before. I've seen lots of TV shows get remade over and over again. There are a million Law and Orders, but I've never seen a sitcom about an all-female Muslim punk rock band from London. And so that's one of the amazing things about streaming. But then the people who would love it might not get to see it.
Kelly Lawler, any famous last words?
Watch We Are Lady Parts on Peacock. It's really good.
Kelly, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
If you like the show, write us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening, and do me a favor, share it with a friend. What do you think of the show, and how has the rise of streaming impacted how you view TV? Email me at jabrown@usatoday.com or leave me a message at 585-484-0339. We might have you on the show. Thanks to Kelly Lawler for joining me, and to Alexis Gustin for our production assistance. Taylor Wilson will be back tomorrow morning. For all of us at USA Today, thanks for listening. I'm James Brown, and as always, be well.
Dr. George Dimitri, medical oncologist, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Over the past 5 years, 51% of all FDA-approved cancer drugs have had substantial input from Dana-Farber scientists and clinical investigators. And that comes from the culture here, the very basic curiosity-driven scientists that are probing really how cancer works, and then the expert clinicians that interact with patients and families every day. It's not easy to have input at a substantive level to new drugs that are safe and effective at treating cancer. So our whole mantra has always been to try to minimize risks to patients and yet try to maximize the opportunity of finding how effective a new treatment could be. And that means understanding cancer really, really deeply.
At Dana-Farber, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.